Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. I got my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr. And with us today, we've got another awesome guest, Dr. McGowan, who is a board-certified gastroenterologist and obesity specialist. And with some of the new procedures coming out that you can do as a GI doctor and some of those studies that have recently come out, we thought it'd be a good time to chat. So welcome, Dr. McGowan.
Thank you, Spencer. Thanks, Carl. Appreciate it. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So tell us about your training. You obviously went to medical school and then did internal medicine, then GI. Then how'd you get into like obesity medicine?
Yeah, I'm in a pretty unique little niche subspecialty of GI currently. So I did my training at University of North Carolina. And shortly after my fellowship training and subspecialty training, this entire field of endoscopic bariatrics was coming online. And so I really shifted courses and got into it pretty early on, mainly because I needed treatment options for my patients with obesity. And this was a pretty exciting area. And it's what I'm 100% focused on at this time. So this is what I do day in and day out, 100% endoscopic bariatrics. And we can talk about the different procedures and options that are available.
So during fellowship, did you start doing that type of stuff? Was there a fellowship after the fellowship, or is it like you kind of had to track in your fellowship?
So this was nearly 10 years ago now, and the field was really in its infancy. And what's interesting, I think, is that there still really isn't a proper fellowship pathway toward this subspecialty. So for me, it was a lot of hands-on learning, really doing it myself and learning along the way, and really in some ways pioneering in this field because it was so new and so novel. So that occurred after my actual training. But I've been 100% in this field for the past 4 years and started my own company and really focused on these techniques.
How long have you been out of fellowship?
2014. I graduated from UNC. 10 years now. Yeah. And so it's interesting. If you look at the endoscopic sleeve, which is my primary specialty, the ESG, when I first started performing this, there were only about 6 publications.
I was going to say, there was not much of that back then. And correct me if I'm wrong, but were, as far as endoscopic procedures go, were the balloons the first one that were actually approved? Because it was around those times, I was in endocrine fellowship working with our bariatric surgeons.
Yeah, we were at TOS.
In that time frame, toying with the idea of how can we at least provide some of these options for our patients. But, we'll get into some of the FDA approval cost issues and coverage issues, I'm sure, from your perspective.
So who taught you?
They're not that old.
Who taught you during fellowship?
So really this was after fellowship. And so I trained with some of the leaders at that time in the field at Hopkins. Vivek Kumbhari was one of my early mentors and now a good friend and collaborator that I work with. And there were a few select training courses in the country where you could really get hands-on experience suturing primarily. I mean, that is the skill set that is the foundation of this field. When you talk about balloons, they were the first FDA-approved treatment back in 2015, but any gastroenterologist can place and remove a balloon. That's pretty straightforward. But when we get into suturing, it's technically more complex. And then there was the whole aspect of the cognitive element and actually treating patients with obesity, not just doing procedures, but actually treating the individual. So it was a several-year process for me. But quickly, I realized, one, how effective the procedures could be, and really life-altering for patients, and just how rewarding that is, which is why I shifted my entire GI practice to this.
Yeah. So I guess I would want to maybe start with what were some of the first ones, like the balloons, because I have a feeling because those weren't as, we didn't get as excited about those as maybe we had hoped for the results. And of course, they're not permanent, right? Which ultimately, I'm going to take a guess that led you down the path that you're doing because it's actually, permanent type procedures that result in real beneficial long-term weight reduction. But can you tell people about the evolution of these procedures? I think, you know, we've talked about the surgeries. We've talked, you know, ad nauseum about the medication. So hopefully our listeners kind of understand the disease of obesity. It's easier said than done. We have a variety of treatment options. We often talk about medicines. We've talked about surgeries, gastric sleeve, gastric bypass. But this is like the kind of little bit of that missing piece that people don't know as much about. And so just a little bit of the history. I mean, you know, for the lay people out there, I guess.
And it's a pretty long history. And so balloons were the first to be FDA approved. And I have a love-hate relationship, mostly hate relationship with balloons to this day. They're a crude tool. There are patients who desire them, who do really well with them, but generally I discourage them. They're just not easy to tolerate, and they have a pretty limited impact generally for patients. Those were FDA approved early on. But what we use for the endoscopic sleeve is a suturing device developed by a company, Apollo Endosurgery, and it was called Overstitch. It's now been bought by Boston Scientific. But that device was actually FDA approved way back in 2008. It was originally developed for defect closure. So the thought was you're removing large polyps, doing dissections in the GI tract, and you need to close those areas endoscopically. It's a great tool to have. So this is a suturing system that can be introduced through the mouth or from below and allow us to close things. But around that time, some physicians said, well, why don't we use this for bariatrics and explore that path? And so the device itself has been around, but the evolution of the techniques using that device took quite a long time. So when I mentioned there were maybe just a few publications when I started, there's now many thousands, and we can touch on some of the more recent ones. And it took until about 2022 for FDA, for the randomized clinical trial of ESG, and then FDA authorization. So it is now, that's now a fully authorized procedure.
So who decided, like, all right, I'm just going to do this for bariatrics?
And describe what it is for people. I mean,
the very basics, like I would be interested, like, how someone goes, all right, I'm going to do this, and they're like, I'm just going to do this without FDA approval, or did they submit for like, hey, I want to try this, start studying it, or did they start just doing it? You know what I mean?
Well, the device had an FDA indication of tissue approximation. So you can, it's kind of a wide scope that you could apply that to. But there were earlier generations of suturing devices within the GI tract that were not as effective. And the reason is they were not what we call full thickness. So if you're suturing a muscular organ like the stomach, the sutures need to pass full thickness through the entirety of the gastric wall so that they hold. It's a very strong organ. And that's why this device is effective. But the earlier generations of devices weren't able to accomplish that, which is why they failed. So it wasn't a new idea per se, but it was adapting a more effective device.
So you stick this, tell us how it works.
Yeah, I'll walk you through it. So basically, our patient's sedated. We insert an endoscope. Most people are familiar with an endoscope if they've had a routine upper endoscopy for evaluation of stomach symptoms, or similar to a colonoscopy. So we guide the scope down into the stomach. Now on the end of the scope is a small suturing device, basically a needle and thread, which we can control outside of the patient. And so there are no incisions. That's really the big difference when we compare this to any type of surgical procedure. So internally we are plicating, imbricating, basically folding the stomach and suturing it into a sleeve-like shape. And that leads to a volume reduction of about 70 to 80%. And the patient will then leave that same day. They go home within about an hour. So advantages of this are really short downtime and very low risk. As soon as you eliminate incisions through the abdominal wall or cutting and stapling, the risk goes down. And so we look at an average risk of about 1 in 1,000. It's kind of similar to a colonoscopy in terms of risk level. That's an advantage.
And say risk of what?
Complications, what most patients are afraid of, you know, when most people think about bariatrics,
yeah, perforation,
leak,
bleeding,
infection, bleeding, these types of things.
Okay. And the shape of it when you do this. So, you know, we've talked about, laparoscopic, meaning the surgeons are, you know, putting holes in their stomachs, right? And then they're cutting half the stomach off, a sleeve gastrectomy, right?
Turning into a banana shape.
Right. So we talked in our one surgical podcast about with Garth, you know, the difference between what people have heard about as restrictive procedures, you know, people don't do a lot of what what's called really malabsorptive procedures, even a gastric bypass isn't, but there's also the metabolic aspect to it, right? So that's why metabolic bariatric surgery for those things. But the sleeve gastrectomy and the sleeve gastroplasty that you do are at least similar shapes, right?
Right.
But describe to people what the difference is. And I know that makes it's obvious to us, but what is the difference between those two things? They sound very similar and are probably very confusing to people.
Yeah, the basis is similar. We are reducing the volume of the stomach, reducing the capacity, which leads to portion control, which leads to greater satiety and satiation. That's where the similarity pretty much ends, though. So surgically, the vertical sleeve gastrectomy, it's the most common bariatric surgery. About 60 to 70% of traditional surgeries in the worldwide are a vertical sleeve, where the stomach is cut into that banana shape. So the stomach's normally a football shape, kind of very stretchy, and then it's made into a tighter banana shape, which reduces capacity. With this procedure, we're creating a similar shape, but it's actually different in many ways. And we can spend a lot of time on the nuances, but ultimately the differences are it is a low pressure system rather than a high pressure system. We talk about that a lot because what that means is patients don't experience acid reflux, which is one advantage of the endoscopic approach. Hmm. With the surgical sleeve, there's a high rate of acid reflux. It's a very tight tube. The capacity is similar, though. Interestingly, I think for both of you as physicians, what's interesting is with a surgical sleeve, it's a fast emptying system. Food enters the sleeve and exits quickly to the small intestine. That's what triggers that satiation. With an endoscopic sleeve, it's kind of the opposite. We are prolonging emptying. So the sleeve that we create is a slow emptying system. So patients eat a smaller amount, hold on to it for longer, feel satisfied for longer, and ultimately lose weight over time.
Is there a known difference of like the ghrelin, the hunger hormone? So in a sleeve gastrectomy, at least we've always said, there's some nuances out there about this, but you know, like we're cutting it off, getting rid of the hunger hormone kind of, right? Or at least in theory, in some biochemical studies. But what about this?
I'm currently obsessed with this topic because this is what I've been studying. My practice, we've been studying this for the past couple of years. It is a key difference between the surgical sleeve and endoscopic sleeve. You're correct. With a surgical sleeve, that top of the stomach, the fundus is cut and removed, at least a properly done sleeve. And that does a couple of things. It leads to volume reduction. So there's less accommodation at the top of the stomach, less capacity. But it also does reduce ghrelin. And we know if we look at studies, there's about a 50% reduction in ghrelin. Ghrelin being the hunger hormone. You know, what makes us hungry? It's a key hormone in the body.
It's also what makes us hangry, according to some of my literature.
It's what makes us hangry. And it's also one of the key reasons why diets in general will fail. We know that ghrelin continues to increase progressively as we lose weight. And so reducing that reduces hunger, but also helps with weight loss and maintenance of weight loss. So we know that's the case with a surgical sleeve. If you look at the endoscopic sleeve, we're not removing anything. So we cannot remove that gastric tissue. There is no immediate reduction in ghrelin. What we are doing is indirectly affecting it by prolonging gastric emptying. And so patients are much less hungry, but not to the degree of a surgical sleeve. And so that's why we see a difference in weight loss, one of the reasons.
Explain the reflux a little bit more. So you're saying with surgery, it goes more quickly through, faster through, but with the endoscopic procedure, not so much because, and explain a little bit more, why is that going?
Yeah, on? There's a couple of reasons. So if we look at a surgical sleeve, think of it as just a very tight tube. You eat, food goes down fast, and reflux, if it's occurring, comes up fast. So very high pressure. So if you're going to have reflux, acidity is going to flow upward quite easily. That's why about a third of patients will have significant reflux after a surgical sleeve. With the endoscopic approach, the stomach is not as tight of a tube, and it's actually more of a squat, compressed sleeve shape based on the suturing pattern we use. Additionally, as we're suturing the stomach, we're actually pulling the stomach downward. And so that lengthens the esophagus. And so that also reduces acid reflux. So when we're about 30% of surgical sleeve patients will have reflux, it's less than 1% in the endoscopic. We really just don't see it.
Can you explain, just for the listeners who aren't physicians, the lower esophageal sphincter, and it just real quick, the food tube and all that, just like very super basic stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
so
all about the food tube, Spencer.
I don't even know what that's supposed to mean.
It's something.
It's definitely something.
Well, the food enters the mouth first, then goes down the food tube, which is known as the esophagus, passes through the lower esophageal sphincter, basically like a valve between the esophagus and stomach. Food will then sit in the stomach. The stomach grinds it up, churns it, mixes it with acid, and then that exits into the small intestine, which is where absorption occurs. With acid reflux, the stomach acidity is basically refluxing up through that valve, that lower esophageal sphincter, into the esophagus, and that's what causes the symptoms of heartburn.
And that's pretty interesting, because that is like the one thing I hear about that leads, that I feel like leads more to revision surgeries. Does that sound right? I mean, it seems like it's the gastric sleeve reflux that drives more of the revision surgeries than anything else. In my, I don't know what the data are for that. That just seems to be what I observe. Is that?
Yeah, that's accurate.
Okay,
that is the number one long-term adverse event or complication from a surgical sleeve, and the remedy, the treatment, is conversion to a gastric bypass, generally, if it's very severe, which, you know, most patients don't want. So a patient who has pre-existing significant acid reflux generally is not a candidate for a surgical sleeve.
So with your so with yours, instead of like, I can imagine you. I'd have to look at a video of how you suture it down. It's pulling it down. It's elongating the tube, just like Casey would be doing. And but like, and that's
again.
And then food doesn't have as much of a risk of then refluxing up. And right. But it's because of the sutures. Then can you allow for more expansion? Is that what you're saying too? Like if it needs to?
Yeah, it's just not as tight of a tube. The other thing we do is generally we leave the fundus kind of alone during the procedure. We leave a little cap on top of the stomach.
Okay.
It serves as a small reservoir. So, acid could potentially pool there as well. So you just don't see it coming straight up the esophagus.
All right. Let's talk about outcomes then, right? So anything else?
Yeah, I guess my question would be, obviously this is not being covered, right? Is that right? And it's not yet recommended by the American Society of Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
It's still, I think, I don't know if it happens to be because of cost and stuff like that, but, you know, we talk all the time about how much weight reduction correlates as a surrogate to the health benefits we're looking for people, right? So 10% weight reduction is really a pretty good goal. 15% or more is where we start to get the really, really good outcomes. Gastric bypass is, you know, well above on average, like 25%, somewhere in the line.
25, 30.
Gastric sleeve, sleeve gastrectomy, around 20 plus.
20, 25.
This is like, are we talking like 15 from what I'm aware of? I know the meta-analyses. I know the comparative analysis.
15 to 20.
Is that about right?
You're right. Yeah. I would say, so it depends on the center. It depends on the study you're looking at. But we generally will tell patients somewhere between 17 and 21% of total body weight loss with the endoscopic sleeve. In our practice, that's on average.
Is there a wide variability there? Kind of like, you know, we do tend to see that in a lot of medicines, maybe less so with some of the more, some of the newer meds, but, we see a little bit of a variable response with other medications. Is there a wide variability, or is everyone kind of close to that mean?
Yeah, it is a bell-shaped curve. And the curve is not quite as narrow as, say, a gastric bypass. So there is definitely some spread. There is some range in response. We know in our center, we've published our data on ESG, and we use that 10% as the bare minimum threshold that we'd like our patients to achieve. And we know that 97% of our patients will lose at least 10% of their body weight. The average would be twice that, but that can give you an idea of where the spread is and how that curve looks. So most patients, the vast majority, will lose at least 10%. The average will lose 15 to 25%. And then you have the exceptional patients who lose more than that. But you're right about a surgical sleeve is more 25 to 28% weight loss. And we're sitting closer to 20% or so.
Okay. Durability. How long? How long is this over? And then how long does it last?
Yeah. So as far as durability, we have less data, definitely, than traditional bariatrics. We have multiple studies at the three-year mark. We have some studies at 5 years, and there's one small abstract that was 10-year follow-up. It's probably a bit less durable than traditional bariatric surgery just by the nature of not cutting away stomach tissue. but I would say it's a definitely a 3 to 5 year significant impact.
But it is, I mean, based upon everything we see so far, pretty durable. I mean, yeah. You know, compared to the other things that you've had experience with, like balloons, which literally are taken out and not durable, like by definition, right?
I mean, that's the downside of a balloon, you know, unless someone wants a purely reversible treatment. But this is a long-term procedure. That's what we tell patients, yeah, with the caveat that no procedure is permanent. No weight intervention is permanent. And we really counsel patients on that.
What's the post-op follow-up stuff like compared to surgery?
Some of that will be program dependent. In our practice, patients follow a pretty traditional bariatric diet progression, liquids for 2 weeks, then some purees, then some soft food. So they have to go through that period of time to allow their stomach to accommodate. And then the foundation of this is nutritional support, lifestyle modification. So our patients are followed monthly by registered dietitians. What we tell our patients is there's the tool and then there's the support. The support and aftercare are probably more important.
What are some of the future look like? So, I mean, obviously, like, they're looking at all sorts of different procedures for surgery, but are there other ways you could suture some other things? And
there are. Do you do any of the endoscopic intestinal, you know, the luminal things that are being studied out
there?
Yeah,
the endo barriers,
right?
Try
to mimic gastric bypass. Although there's been a lot of skepticism with some of that stuff. I'm pretty skeptical. I love the what you do so far when I've seen in the literature, but.
Yeah, we're really just getting started in this field. And so there are a few areas where things will be going. The next frontier, there are two main frontiers. We need to have more of a metabolic impact. So right now, everything is reducing capacity. It's restrictive in nature. And that alone is not enough. That's why we see less weight loss compared to a surgery. So one area, one territory is small bowel interventions. These are in development, including treating the lining of the duodenum for a metabolic impact. So liners, I would say, probably not the future of this field. That is putting a plastic tube, a sheet, you know, line the intestine to block absorption. That's kind of a crude intervention. That's still a tool. That's still a device. What we want to do is remodel the intestinal lining. And so there are different ways to do that through heat, through electricity. And when you basically destroy and allow that tissue to regenerate, it's metabolically more healthy. And so it can actually be a treatment for diabetes. So some of these early studies have demonstrated that.
Yeah, that's where I've read about it, you know, during, you know, the years in fellowship, seeing the progression of some of those things that were certainly intriguing to, you know, to endocrinologists, diabetes, et cetera. But still, I don't know. There were just enough things where I was like, I don't know. We'll see, I guess.
Well, and they need to be safe. And that's really a priority.
Exactly.
The other area, when I mentioned I'm pretty excited about ghrelin, is what we've been studying in our practice and now a few other centers around the world is ablation. So thermal treatment, basically burning the lining of the gastric fundus to reduce ghrelin. So we studied this. The concept is pretty straightforward. We know that ghrelin cells live, 90% of them live in the mucosal lining, that innermost lining of the gastric fundus. So endoscopically, it's what we look at every day. We can see it, we can treat it. And so we've been studying this and we'll be presenting our initial study findings next month at Digestive Diseases Week. And it's quite fascinating what we are able to achieve. And so I think this is another area where we could potentially then combine a restrictive procedure with a procedure that has more of a metabolic impact. And, you know, we hear nonstop about head hunger and food noise and these things that medications really do quell. If we can do that through a procedural intervention, that's another option for maybe a different set of patients.
Yeah, that's great.
Are you doing a lot of combo therapy, like with medicines at your clinic?
We do. Certainly. Yeah. No, we treat many, many patients with GLP medications, either monotherapy or in combination. A patient who needs to lose more than the average and is undergoing a procedure would do better with combination therapy. But most patients who are coming to us either don't want surgery, most commonly, so they're looking for something less invasive. And these days have tried GLPs, either can't tolerate them, can't afford them, can't obtain them, you know, all the things that you both know about in terms of barriers, and are looking for really a one-time procedural intervention.
Well, then that brings us to a little bit of this, you know, cost-effectiveness stuff, because that's what, you know, was recently published. The bottom line of it was that it compared endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty with semaglutide/Wegovy, right? And they have their mathematical analyses that I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm sure they have actuaries that are like figuring this out, right? And the bottom line of it was that the Wegovy would have to be, instead of being like $13,000 a year, it would have to be like $3,000 a year to have a similar cost effectiveness for a very like uncomplicated male with obesity, with a BMI between like 35 and 39. That was kind of it. So it wasn't about diabetes. It wasn't about anything else. You know what I mean? But just in general quality of life years, you know, all that stuff that they put into that mathematical equation. And so it's certainly different for people who have type 2 diabetes, atherosclerotic disease, where we have such good outcome data, but still, you know, it makes you think about it. And I know that, I don't know how much your procedure costs. And I think I know that it's not really covered by insurance yet. Is that right? So,
right.
Yeah. What does it all entail?
Let's talk through that. Yeah. So it's an important paper for the field, but I want to be careful in how much we interpret it and how we interpret it. Mm-hmm. I don't believe the motivation of the study was to say that ESG is better than semaglutide. This is purely looking at cost effectiveness. And we know that semaglutide is not cost effective at its current price point. I mean, that's mm-hmm. been looked at by ICER. It's not even close. And so it's not hard to say that a single one-time intervention that costs between $10,000 and $16,000 roughly is going to be more cost effective. That's not really surprising. I think what the intention of this paper is to really is directed at payers and insurers, mm-hmm. because you're right, the endoscopic sleeve is not currently covered by insurance. And it takes time, of course, it's a newer procedure, but it's an option that should be considered by payers, because we know that patients need as many options as possible.
Yeah, it's very surprising to me, I guess, knowing that, I mean, this is the leading procedure, right? I mean, the other thing, I mean, yeah, balloons, to me, that's that thing's...
I don't know who's doing that anymore.
No, nobody does it. I can't imagine that would be covered. But what this procedure, I don't know why it's not yet. And I don't quite know how that all goes in the procedural surgical world. So why is it not? And is it like pending, you know, coverage in a lot of different ways? What's going on there?
Yeah. Well, keep in mind, it is still relatively new. I mean, I've been performing this for many years and it's been in evolution for 10 years, but it took some time for the randomized controlled study that had to be completed. Mm-hmm. And that was only released and published in Lancet just a couple of years ago. And that led to FDA authorization. It does not have a procedural code yet. And that's the biggest mm-hmm. barrier right now. There's no CPT code. So insurers don't even know how to value it properly. So that is probably another 2 to 3 years away. And then Medicare has to look at it and value it. And then the other insurers get involved. So there are just many, many steps involved in this process. So right now it is self-pay. And that's mm-hmm. clearly an obstacle for people obtaining this. The other is awareness. Very few people are even aware that this exists.
Yeah. But, you know, for the people out there who are paying out of pocket or high deductible plans for the medications that we provide, especially if they're not getting those extra metabolic benefits, like if they have, you know, really bad prediabetes, type 2 diabetes, atherosclerotic disease, where we have really good outcome data, this sure sounds, I mean, we already just mentioned that the cost effectiveness data are there, right? For the weight reduction,
right,
and the expected benefits. But boy, that would sound pretty good to me, you know, thinking of a high deductible plan, HSA, because I didn't know what the cost was until you literally just said that.
Right. So first of all, I would never say that this is better than medication. It's not better than surgery. It's a different option.
It's different.
For different options for different patients. But a patient who is looking at their options and has no coverage for a GLP and is facing paying potentially $15,000 per year, year after year, well, then a single cost upfront of once that then carries forward for years may be financially more attractive. Now, that patient does have to be comfortable undergoing a procedure. I mean, it's low risk, but it's still a procedure and they need to be comfortable with that. But absolutely, when you're purely looking at cost, most patients aren't thinking about the incremental cost effectiveness ratios, but they're thinking about what's this going to cost me each month and then over the course of a year and what impact will it have on my health?
Yeah.
So if I had a patient in Raleigh, where are you? What's your clinic called?
True U Weight Loss. We're in Cary, North Carolina, and Atlanta, Georgia.
All right. So if I sent a patient your way and insurance wouldn't cover it, how much upfront would it cost?
In our program, it's $12,000 for the entire program. Now we bundle everything together. I mean, we have to really provide as much as we can.
Do like payment plans, or how does it work?
Patients can finance, so we use medical lenders. We really provide every option available for patients to pay for this. So reducing costs to just a monthly payment, that's what patients will frequently do. Of course, you can imagine people pay in different ways.
How many of these do you do per week, per month?
It really varies. We are a high volume center, so we will treat between 500 and 1,000 patients a year with these types of procedures.
Wow. Nice.
There's an immense need, and we're fortunate that there are newer therapies. And prior to GLPs, we really had nothing. We had traditional bariatric surgery, which we know most people don't want. This field was just coming online. So again, lots of options, but for the patient who is maybe unable to obtain meds or simply doesn't want to add a medication to their list, we know that that occurs, this can be an option.
So there are a lot of patients that are like, I'm going to Mexico to get a sleeve or a bypass. For those listening, there's an FDA approved option for you in the United States that's actually I would call it affordable, but maybe
right.
Not everybody.
It's all relative, right? So how many people out there? So not everyone's going to be able to go see you in North Carolina or your colleagues in Atlanta.
Yeah, how many people are doing this?
Yeah, is this relatively accessible? I need to look into what's in my local area, and now Spencer and I kind of live near each other, but I need to figure out who's doing this, because I don't know a lot of people. I would think I would know, but I don't hear a lot of other people doing this.
Right. And it's not widely available. And there's a few reasons. We talked about insurance coverage. That's why most patients don't know about it. There's the cost barriers, but there's a technical barrier to this. It is a very technical procedure. It is a very long, very steep learning curve. It takes years to master. And it is 100% dependent on the individual performing it. This is not a stapler that just staples off a sleeve and you're done. I mean, maybe that's a little bit oversimplified. but it really depends on the individual doing it. And an endoscopic sleeve not performed properly is not going to provide much for that patient. And so I would, there are expert centers around the country, but a true expert high volume centers, it's probably only half a dozen.
Okay.
Wow. So are there places that are going to develop fellowships?
Yes. So the paper that you mentioned with the cost effectiveness, Chris Thompson, who is really one of the true pioneers in the field, he's at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and they have really the one fellowship in the country, and they train one physician a year. Wow. So it's not like every GI fellowship in the country is churning out experts in this area.
Do you do general GI still, or is this all you do?
I do not. No, I have shifted 100% to this field.
So, this is just another thing. I mean, obviously, I think there's some med students and residents who are probably listening to this going like, hey, kind of an attractive field.
Yeah.
Would be like, I hate surgery. So those who like internal medicine who also want to get into procedures, I think it's known as one of those fields, but
it's a nice little compromise.
But if you like the obesity world, it's like, hey, I could do internal medicine. Yeah. And if you don't want to do the endocrine route, like my brother, you could go into this and be a little bit more procedural. I mean, honestly, if my brother went into GI, he would be sewing my elbow to my asshole. So
he's saying
I would suck at that. Yeah, I would be terrible.
Yeah. I guarantee I'd be better.
Your fundus would be at your duodenom. I don't even know. Your stomach would be upside down.
It would be like that weird movie. Isn't there that movie like The Centipede or something?
Oh God.
Oh yeah.
That's terrible.
Yeah, that's a thought.
Yeah, that would be Spencer.
I would do that on purpose.
No, it'd be on accident.
Well, GI in general just signed off. I'm still here. Yeah, no, GI is it's a great field. I mean, well, obviously that's why I chose it, because you get to use your hands. It's procedural. It's cognitive. It's everything. But I think this is even better. Again, I'm highly biased, but you start treating patients with obesity and treating weight, it's better than anything else. Back in the when I was just performing general treating patients for general GI and treating conditions like Crohn's disease, helping someone get into a remission with inflammatory bowel disease is a big deal, and they appreciate it. But it's not even close to helping someone lose 50 pounds.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, especially no one, when they have the complications that suddenly go into remission. I mean, that's, I mean, that's our world that we, that is very, very, very rewarding.
So a multidisciplinary center would have whatever, someone like me, someone like my brother, someone like you, and then a surgeon, right? That would be the ideal situation.
Yeah. At a minimum, a center performing these procedures must have a nutrition team, registered dietitians. Yeah. You really need that foundation and that support.
That's really cool. I think it's the future is just wild because it's just like thinking outside the box. Very cool. Anything else you want to share with us that's about this stuff? I mean, I think we covered most of it, but
yeah, especially a lot the of focus territory. On the gastroplasty, I think. Did you ever do the, what's it called, where it was the... where it basically was the bulimic device.
The Inspire.
Aspire. Aspire Assist.
So,
did you or anybody else actually ever do that?
I sure did. Yeah. So that was 2016. That was FDA approved. The stomach pump, it had other names. Yeah. But the Aspire Assist was the device. Do we really want to talk about this?
No, I mean, not really.
No. Just, it, the thing
it's
is,
it's a fascinating
though,
device.
It actually worked.
It worked. Yeah. Yeah. So I treated about 25 patients with that device, and some... I literally just removed months ago. They had it for 4 or 5 years. So this is a basically reverse feeding tube that was inserted endoscopically through the stomach and would allow patients to remove food from their stomachs after eating. It sounds terrible, but it actually gave patients control over eating. And for those who didn't want a gastric bypass, allowed them to, it's a way to, you know, reduce caloric load, I suppose. But mm-hmm. Some did really well. It didn't catch on, as you could imagine.
Yeah, I mean,
I think it's more of a principle, like a philosophical issue. But I mean, I was always surprised, like, wow, the data are actually, they're pretty good. I mean, people had good weight reduction, especially compared to some of the other.
Because the worry would be like disordered type of.
Well, it was never shown in the studies, and I never saw it firsthand. And truthfully, patients who committed to the process really did exceptionally well. Yeah. The problem is you'd have to spend like 30 minutes after every meal pumping.
It really is. I mean, it sounds horrible, but it really was kind of a bulimic device, basically. I mean,
somewhat, some things will come and go, right? Yeah. I mean, the evidence was there, but that wasn't really ready for clinical mm-hmm. adoption on a widespread scale. But there's so much future here and potential. And when we're looking at, you know, hundreds of millions of adults who need assistance, the more tools, the better.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Sounds great. Really, really intriguing, really exciting, I think.
Yeah, thanks for coming out. We'll have to have you again. Oh, and tell everybody, so like if anybody's like, hey, I got patients, I want to go see Dr. McGowan, how do they get you?
So you can reach me at trueyouweightloss.com. Certainly patients who are interested, physicians who are interested in, or med students or anyone else interested in learning about this area. We love to welcome trainees and physicians to come and observe and learn. And that's a lot of fun. So yep, that's how you can reach us, trueyouweightloss.com.
Very cool. Awesome. Love it. Here's our outro. Thanks.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.